I ride in this wind on my good horse, I call you.
How to be a poet, to remind myself.
To the playhouse of fortune.
Make a place to sit down.
Take the bright silver.
Sit down. Be quiet. You must depend upon affection, reading, knowledge, skill, more of each than you have, inspiration, work, growing older, patience, for patience joins time to eternity. Any readers who like your poems doubt their judgment. Breathe with unconditional breath the unconditioned air. Shun electric wire. Communicate slowly. Live a three-dimensioned life. Stay away from screens. Stay away from anything that obscures the place it is in. There are no unsacred places. There are only sacred places and desecrated places. Accept what comes from silence. Make the best you can of it. Of the little words that come out of the silence like prayers prayed back to the one who prays. Make a poem that does not disturb the silence from which it came.
You're listening to episode 642 of Unwelcome Guests. Living a three-dimensional life. I'm Robin Upton, and that unusually long introduction featured Wendell Berry reading his poem on how to be a poet. As a change of pace from our usual fact-packed, informational style, we have some much more reflective material for you this week. The mainstay of which is going to be a contrast of two men. I think they were in their 30s when they decided to live slightly differently, to go and live apart from conventional society. Both of them philosophers seeking a more reflective existence, certainly closer to nature. One is quite celebrated, Henry David Thoreau, the American transcendentalist from the 19th century, and another from the 21st, who's featured on the show before, but is in most respects not very well celebrated. I'm a big fan of a lot of his ideas. Daniel Swalo, who gave up using money a decade or so ago. But we're going to start the show with a few minutes of recollections by Jack Fresno, the architect behind the Venus Project. If you have any thoughts or experience on that, I'd be keen to hear them. You can email me, unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net. And there is a video which goes with this. It was taken from YouTube, and I'll post it on the show's webpage, unwelcomeguests.net/642.
When I was a young man, growing up in New York City, I refused the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. Of course, I was sent to the principal's office, and he asked me, "Why don't you want a Pledge of Allegiance? Everybody does." I said, "Everybody once believed the earth was flat, but that doesn't make it so." I explained that America owed everything it has to other cultures and other nations, and that I would rather pledge allegiance to the earth and everyone on it. Needless to say, it wasn't long before I left school entirely. And I set up a lab in my bedroom. There I began to learn about science and nature. I realized then that the universe is governed by laws and that the human being, along with society itself, was not exempt from these laws. Then came the crash of 1929, which began what we now call the Great Depression. I found it difficult to understand why millions were out of work, homeless, starving, while all the factories were sitting there. The resources were unchanged. It was then that I realized that the rules of the economic game were inherently invalid. Shortly after came World War II, where various nations took turns systematically destroying each other. I later calculated that all the destruction and wasted resources spent on that war could have easily provided for every human need on the planet. Since that time, I have watched humanity set the stage for its own extinction. I have watched as the precious finite resources are perpetually wasted and destroyed in the name of profit and free markets. I have watched the social values of society be reduced into a base artificiality of materialism and mindless consumption. And I have watched as the monetary powers control the political structure of supposedly free societies. I'm 94 years old now, and I'm afraid my disposition is the same as it was 75 years ago. This s*** got to go.
And now I'm going to read some questions from Daniel Swaler's FAQ on his website, which is entitled, I Know It's Possible to Live Abundantly Without Money. Question 1. Why do you live without money? A biographical intro. This is the only way I know to live with a clear conscience. The reasons are many. Here are some main ones. It's instinctual. It's for political reasons, spiritual reasons, health reasons, mental and physical, economic reasons, and because it's just plain fun, seriously. It's instinctual. Actually, you and I and everybody lived moneyless, without consciousness of credit and debt when we were born. Our true selves already live moneyless. The rest is bogus illusion. This lifestyle is the nature and desire of children. Any child or young person I talk to, not yet too programmed by the man, thinks it's cool. All creatures, all the universe, outside the walls of commercial civilization, live moneyless. That's why nature outside civilization's constructs is perfectly balanced. Yet no nation on earth, even with its PhD economists, can even balance its budget. Political. This requires little explanation. Look at politics. Look at America's and the world's rampant materialism. Look at the droves of churches backing these politics, trying to hide greed under mask of piety. Look at corporations, world trade. Need I say more? Their fruit speaks for itself. Spiritual. Mixed with my kid instincts, I grew up in an evangelical Christian home. I took my religion seriously. But I started wondering why professed Christians rarely follow the teachings of Jesus, namely the Sermon on the Mount, namely giving up possessions, living beyond credit and debt, freely giving and freely taking, giving expecting nothing in return, forgiving all debts, owing nobody a thing, living beyond payback of either evil for evil or good for good, living and walking without guilt, that is debt, without grudge, debt, without judgment, credit and debt, living by grace, gratis, not for our own works, but by the works of the true nature flowing through us. As I grew older, opening up my mind, I started learning that these principles of Christianity are the principles of every religion, like Taoism, Judaism, Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism, Sikhism, Islam, Mormonism, Shamanism, Paganism, etc. Despite the institutionalized bastardizations of each of these religions selling their spirit for 30 pieces of silver, no religion has a monopoly on truth, and those farthest from their own truth are the ones who think themselves are the only true church. The core principles of the world's religions are the very principles of nature, the law written on every heart. And you know this at your deepest core. Didn't Jesus use the examples of the ravines, lilies, rain raining on the just and the unjust, sparrows, seeds, and our own hearts to drive home these points? However, this brought me to a point where I was sick of studying and babbling about religion and philosophy, because I couldn't practice them. Nobody did. Nobody could. Then I entered a phase of cynicism, bitterness, spiraling into clinical depression, and disdain for all religion and talk of things spiritual, disdain for conceptions of God. Health. I had lived in Denver and Boulder, Colorado, and decided I was sick of the rat race. So I gave up my job and moved to Moab, Utah. I eventually started realizing that the only way to overcome depression was to simplify my thoughts, let them go. This is Buddhism 101, the inevitable result of anybody wanting to heal. And then I realized my stuff was also my thoughts. As I let go of useless thoughts, I let go of useless possessions. And as I let go of useless possessions, I found more and more that I needed less and less. It wasn't an effort, but more like a tree dropping its leaves or seeds. And with my possessions, possessions of thoughts and stuff and people, flew away my depression. But this odyssey continued to go even deeper. Every time I made a resume for a job, signed my name to a document, opened a bank account, or even bought a banana at the supermarket, I felt a tinge of dishonesty, like I was not letting my yes be yes and my no be no. Yeah, you know what I'm talking about, everybody does. I was becoming super sensitive to this basic knowledge. Even the slightest seed of dishonesty was just that, a seed. One seed can populate the mind, the whole earth. One dark eye can darken the whole body, the entire universe. 1 year I went to Alaska with my two friends, Leslie and Mel, in their van, and spent the late spring, summer, and early fall there. At first I worked on the docks. But none of it felt honest, so I quit and decided to go on a solo pack trip and try to live off the land for a few weeks. Lo and behold, I ran into a Basque dude named Ander, who was also toying with thoughts of living off the land, so that's what we did. We speared fish, ate mushrooms and berries, and lived very well. And then we hit the road, hitchhiking, and realized how generous people were, and were astonished at the plethora of magical coincidences that kept happening to us. Eventually we split up, and I decided to hitch all the way back to Moab, Utah, with $50 in my pocket just to see if I could. When I arrived in Moab, I had $25 left. Then I realized that I'd only use money for things I didn't need, like snacks and a beer. For the first time, I realized that I could live totally moneyless. Economic. During my time in Alaska, I was also thinking about the concept of the world's debts, banking, corporations, war, and poverty. My constant mantra was, "Forgive us our debts, even as we forgive our debtors." For I was realizing more and more that there really isn't a line of division between physical debt and spiritual debt. Physical and spiritual debt are Siamese twins. I knew, from gradually becoming liberated from clinical depression, that mental debts, called guilt and vengeance, were inextricably linked with physical debts. And mental debts are also inextricably linked with physical disease. And compassion doesn't judge debtors, but forgives them, just as healers don't judge the sick, but heal them. make them whole, accept them as a whole. The love of money, the attachment to credit and debt, truly is the root of all evil, all dis-ease, all uneasiness. Nothing I'm saying here requires research or proof, because all the evidence is right within you. Just take time to look. It's just plain fun, seriously. I became fascinated with Hindu sadhus who wander in India without money and possessions. I wanted to become one. A couple of years after my Alaska odyssey, I went to India with a close friend, Michael. Actually, since we'd gotten killer deal tickets to Thailand, we went to Thailand first. There I ran into a Buddhist monk named Sumetho and got whisked away to a Buddhist monastery in northern Thailand, outside Chiang Mai. It was a life-changing experience. Then I hooked up with Michael again, and we hopped to India. After wandering in India for a couple of months, I ended up at Makliad Ganj, near Dharamshala, where Tibetan refugees are. And the Dalai Lama happened to be there, and I got to hear his talks for a week. Then he turned to us Westerners. He said he thought it was admirable that a few people came from all lands to explore Tibetan Buddhism. But he emphasized that truth is found in every religion, and perhaps only a few could find fulfillment in another faith. Otherwise, he recommended that everybody go back to where they were planted, rather than trying to find greener grass on the other side of the fence. This clinched it for me. What good would it do for me to be a sadhu in India? A true test of faith would be to return to one of the most materialistic, money-worshipping nations on earth, to return to the authentically profound principles of spirituality hidden beneath our own religion of hypocrisy, and be a sadhu there. This idea exhilarated me. I can be a sadhu in America, I thought. To be a vagabond, a bum, and make an art of it, this idea entrenched me. The idea of it was just plain fun. So months later, over a decade ago, that's what I did. To become as a child is to return to understanding fun. We'll hear more from Swelo later on. Compare and contrast his experience with that of Henry David Thoreau, one of the most celebrated individuals who ran away from it all, went to live in the middle of nowhere. Actually, not in the middle of nowhere, quite close to town as it happens. This is 8 minutes in to the LibriVox recording of his most celebrated book, Walden.
I see young men, my townsmen, whose misfortune it is to have inherited farms, houses, barns, cattle, and farming tools, for these are more easily acquired than got rid of. Better if they had been born in the open pasture and suckled by a wolf, that they might have seen with clearer eyes what field they were called to labor in. Who made them serfs of the soil? Why should they eat their 60 acres, when man is condemned to eat only his peck of dirt? Why should they begin digging their graves as soon as they are born? They have got to live a man's life, pushing all these things before them, and get on as well as they can. How many a poor, immortal soul have I met well-nigh crushed and smothered under its load, creeping down the road of life, pushing before it a barn 75 feet by 40, its Augean stables never cleansed, and 100 acres of land, tillage, mowing, pasture, and woodlot. The portionless, who struggle with no such unnecessary inherited encumbrances, find it labor enough to subdue and cultivate a few cubic feet of flesh. But men labor under a mistake. The better part of the man is soon plowed into the soil for compost. By a seeming fate, commonly called necessity, they are employed, as it says in an old book, laying up treasures which moth and rust will corrupt and thieves break through and steal. It is a fool's life, as they will find when they get to the end of it, if not before. It is said that Deucalion and Pyrrha created men by throwing stones over their heads behind them. Inde genus durum sumus experiensque laborum, e documenta damus quasimus origine nati. Or, as Raleigh rhymes it in his sonorous way, from thence our kind hard-hearted is, enduring pain and care, approving that our bodies of a stony nature are. So much for a blind obedience to a blundering oracle, throwing the stones over their heads behind them, and not seeing where they fell. Most men, even in this comparatively free country, through mere ignorance and mistake, are so occupied with the factitious cares and superfluously coarse labors of life that its finer fruits cannot be plucked by them. Their fingers, from excessive toil, are too clumsy and tremble too much for that. Actually, the laboring man has not leisure for a true integrity day by day. He cannot afford to sustain the manliest relations to men. His labor would be depreciated in the market. He has no time to be anything but a machine. How can he remember well his ignorance, which his growth requires, who has so often to use his knowledge? We should feed and clothe him gratuitously sometimes, and recruit him with our cordials, before we judge of him. The finest qualities of our nature, like the bloom on fruits, can be preserved only by the most delicate handling. Yet we do not treat ourselves, nor one another, thus tenderly. Some of you, we all know, are poor, find it hard to live, are sometimes, as it were, gasping for breath. I have no doubt that some of you who read this book are unable to pay for all the dinners which you have actually eaten, or for the coats and shoes which are fast wearing or already worn out, and have come to this page to spend borrowed or stolen time, robbing your creditors of an hour. It is very evident what mean and sneaking lives many of you live, for my sight has been whetted by experience. Always on the limits, trying to get into business, trying to get out of debt, a very ancient slow, called by the Latins Ace Alienum, another's brass, for some of their coins were made of brass, still living and dying and buried by this other's brass, always promising to pay tomorrow, and dying today, insolvent, seeking to curry favor, to get custom, by how many modes, only not state prison offenses, lying, flattering, voting, contracting yourself into a nutshell of civility, or dilating into an atmosphere of thin and vaporous generosity, that you may persuade your neighbor to let you make his shoes, or his hat, or his coat, or his carriage, or import his groceries for him, making yourself sick, that you may lay up something against a sick day, something to be tucked away in an old chest, or in a stocking behind the plastering, or more safely in the brick bank. No matter where, no matter how much, or how little. I sometimes wonder that we can be so frivolous. I may almost say, as to attend to the gross but somewhat foreign form of servitude called Negro slavery. There are so many keen and subtle masters that enslave both North and South. It is hard to have a Southern overseer. It is worse to have a Northern one. But worst of all, when you are the slave driver of yourself.
Gilly was an engineer. He had a job in Jersey, working very near a toxic swamp.
One morning at 10 o'clock, he felt the pull of destiny. Something called him from the toxic swamp. So he left his cubicle and walked out of the building. Told his boss that he would be right back. Walked across the parking lot. The methane smelled real good to him as he headed for the misty, toxic swamp. He saw the glow of the green and orange water, and the rays of light bounced around him like super balls. You should have seen the smiles on all the giant reptiles as they lit up cigars and made a toast. Said, we welcome you, we want to offer you a job designing things that giant reptiles need. We would do the work ourselves, but none of us are qualified. We're not that smart and we don't have opposable thumbs. Gil never could resist a challenge to his intellect. He never could resist a challenge to his opposable thumbs. He pulled a T-square and a slide rule from his pocket and said, I'll build the things you reptiles need. Was an engineer, but now he's a consultant. Everywhere the giant reptiles live, building super freeways, connecting swamps around the globe. He's finding job fulfillment in the swamp. He's building driving theaters in the swamp. He's feeling very human in the swamp.
That music break was Toxic Swamp by Kenny Young and the Eggplants. And now we return to where we left off in Henry David Thoreau's Walden.
Talk of a divinity in man? Look at the teamster on the highway, wending to market by day or night. Does any divinity stir within him? His highest duty to fodder and water his horses. What is his destiny to him compared with the shipping interests? Does not he drive for Squire Makester? How godlike, how immortal is he? See how he cowers and sneaks. How vaguely all the day he fears, not being immortal nor divine, but the slave and prisoner of his own opinion of himself, a fame won by his own deeds. Public opinion is a weak tyrant compared with our own private opinion. What a man thinks of himself, that it is which determines, or rather indicates, his fate. Self-emancipation, even in the West Indian provinces of the fancy and imagination, what Wilberforce is there to bring that about? Think also of the ladies of the land weaving toilet cushions against the last day, not to betray too green an interest in their fates. As if you could kill time without injuring eternity. The mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation. What is called resignation is confirmed desperation. From the desperate city you go into the desperate country, and have to console yourself with the bravery of minks and muskrats. A stereotyped but unconscious despair is concealed even under what are called the games and amusements of mankind. There is no play in them, for this comes after work. But it is a characteristic of wisdom not to do desperate things.
Leave, don't leave me. around. Choose your own ground. How you live, how you fly. Smiles you'll give and tears you'll cry. All you touch and all you see is all your life will ever be. Run, rabbit, run. Dig that hole, get the sun. When at last the work is done, rounds it down, it's time to dig another one.
And that was a snippet of Pink Floyd's Breathe. We continue where we left off with Walden.
When we consider what, to use the words of the Catechism, is the chief end of man, and what are the true necessaries and means of life, it appears as if men had deliberately chosen the common mode of living because they preferred it to any other. Yet they honestly think there is no choice left. But alert and healthy natures remember that the sun rose clear. It is never too late to give up our prejudices. No way of thinking or doing, however ancient, can be trusted without proof. What everyone echoes, or in silence passes by as true today, may turn out to be falsehood tomorrow, mere smoke of opinion, which some had trusted for a cloud that would sprinkle fertilizing rain on their fields. What old people say you cannot do, you try and find that you can. Old deeds for old people, and new deeds for new. Old people did not know enough once, perchance, to fetch fresh fuel to keep the fire a-going. New people put a little dry wood under a pot and are whirled round the globe with the speed of birds. In a way, to kill old people, as the phrase is. Age is no better, hardly so well qualified for an instructor as youth, for it has not profited so much as it has lost. One may almost doubt if the wisest man has learned anything of absolute value by living. Practically, the old have no very important advice to give the young. Their own experience has been so partial, and their lives have been such miserable failures, for private reasons, as they must believe. And it may be that they have some faith left which belies that experience, and they are only less young than they were. I have lived some 30 years on this planet, and I have yet to hear the first syllable of valuable or even earnest advice from my seniors. They have told me nothing, and probably cannot tell me anything to the purpose. Here is life, an experiment to a great extent untried by me. But it does not avail me that they have tried it. If I have any experience which I think valuable, I am sure to reflect that this my mentors said nothing about. One farmer says to me, "You cannot live on vegetable food solely, for it furnishes nothing to make bones with." And so he religiously devotes a part of his day to supplying his system with the raw material of bones, walking all the while he talks behind his oxen, which, with vegetable-made bones, jerk him and his lumbering plow along in spite of every obstacle. Some things are really necessaries of life in some circles. The most helpless and diseased, which in others are luxuries merely, and in others still are entirely unknown. The whole ground of human life seems to some to to have been gone over by their predecessors, both the heights and the valleys, and all things to have been cared for. According to Evelyn, the wise Solomon prescribed ordinances for the very distances of trees, and the Roman praetors have decided how often you may go into your neighbor's land to gather the acorns which fall on it without trespass, and what share belongs to that neighbor. Hippocrates has even left directions how we should cut our nails, that is, even with the end of the fingers, neither shorter nor longer. Undoubtedly, the very tedium and ennui which presume to have exhausted the variety and joys of life are as old as Adam. But man's capacities have never been measured, nor are we to judge of what he can do by any precedents. So little has been tried. Whatever have been thy failures hitherto, quote, "Be not afflicted, my child, for who shall assign to thee what thou hast left undone?" End quote. We might try our lives by a thousand simple tests, as, for instance, that the same sun which ripens my beans illumines at once a system of earths like ours. If I had remembered this, it would have prevented some mistakes. This was not the light in which I hoed them. The stars are the apexes of what wonderful triangles! What distant and different beings, in the various mansions of the universe, are contemplating the same one at the same moment! Nature and human life are as various as our several constitutions. Who shall say what prospect life offers to another? Could a greater miracle take place than for us to look through each other's eyes for an instant? We should live in all the ages of the world in an hour, aye, in all the worlds of the ages. History, poetry, mythology, I know of no reading of another's experience so startling and informing as this would be. The greater part of what my neighbors call good, I believe in my soul to be bad, and if I repent of anything, it is very likely to be my good behavior. What demon possessed me when I behaved so well? You may say the wisest thing you can, old man, you who have lived 70 years, not without honor of a kind. I hear an irresistible voice which invites me away from all that. One generation abandons the enterprises of another like stranded vessels. I think that we may safely trust a good deal more than we do. We may waive just so much care of ourselves as we honestly bestow elsewhere. Nature is as well adapted to our weakness as to our strength. The incessant anxiety and strain of some is a well-nigh incurable form of disease. We are made to exaggerate the importance of what work we do, and yet how much is not done by us? Or what if we had been taken sick? How vigilant we are, determined not to live by faith if we can avoid it. All the day long on the alert, at night we unwittingly say our prayers and commit ourselves to uncertainties. So thoroughly and sincerely are we compelled to live, reverencing our life, denying the possibility of change. This is the only way, we say. But there are as many ways as there can be drawn radii from one center. All change is a miracle to contemplate. But it is a miracle which is taking place every instant. Confucius said, quote, "To know that we know what we know, and that we do not know what we do not know, that is true knowledge." End quote. When one man has reduced a fact of the imagination to be a fact to his understanding, I foresee that all men at length establish their lives on that basis. Let us consider for a moment what most of the trouble and anxiety which I have referred to is about, and how much it is necessary that we be troubled, or at least careful. It would be some advantage to live a primitive and frontier life, though in the midst of an outward civilization, if only to learn what are the gross necessaries of life, and what methods have been taken to obtain them, or even to look over the old day-books of the merchants, to see what it was that men most commonly bought at the stores, what they stored, that is, what are the grossest groceries. For the improvements of ages have had but little influence on the essential laws of man's existence. As our skeletons, probably, are not to be distinguished from those of our ancestors. By the words necessary of life, I mean whatever of all that man obtains by his own exertions has been from the first or from long use has become so important to human life that few, if any, whether from savageness or poverty or philosophy, ever attempt to do without it. To many creatures, there is in this sense but one necessary of life, food. To the bison of the prairie, it is a few inches of palatable grass with water to drink, unless he seeks the shelter of the forest or the mountain's shadow. None of the brute creation requires more than food and shelter. The necessaries of life for man in this climate may, accurately enough, be distributed under the several heads of food, shelter, clothing, and fuel. For not till we have secured these are we prepared to entertain the true problems of life with freedom and a prospect of success. Man has invented not only houses, but clothes and cooked food, and possibly from the accidental discovery of the warmth of fire and the consequent use of it, at first a luxury, arose the present necessity to sit by it. We observe cats and dogs acquiring the same second nature. By proper shelter and clothing, we legitimately retain our own internal heat. But with an excess of these, or of fuel, that is, with an external heat greater than our own internal, may not cookery properly be said to begin? Darwin, the naturalist, says of the inhabitants of Tierra del Fuego that while his own party, who were well clothed and sitting close to a fire, were far from too warm, these naked savages, who were farther off, were observed, to his great surprise, to be streaming with perspiration at undergoing such a roasting. So we are told the New Hollander goes naked with impunity, while the European shivers in his clothes. Is it impossible to combine the hardiness of these savages with the intellectualness of the civilized man? According to Liebig, man's body is a stove, and food the fuel which keeps up the internal combustion in the lungs. In cold weather, we eat more, in warm, less. The animal heat is the result of a slow combustion, and disease and death take place when this is too rapid, or for want of fuel, or from some defect in the draft, the fire goes out. Of course, the vital heat is not to be confounded with fire, but so much for analogy. It appears, therefore, from the above list, that the expression animal life is nearly synonymous with the expression animal heat. For while food may be regarded as the fuel which keeps up the fire within us, and fuel serves only to prepare that food or to increase the warmth of our bodies by addition from without. Shelter and clothing also serve only to retain the heat thus generated and absorbed. The grand necessity, then, for our bodies is to keep warm, to keep the vital heat in us. What pains we accordingly take, not only with our food and clothing and shelter, but with our beds, which are our night clothes, robbing the nests and breasts of birds to prepare this shelter within a shelter, as the mole has its bed of grass and leaves at the end of its burrow. The poor man is wont to complain that this is a cold world, and to cold, no less physical than social, we refer directly a great part of our ails. The summer, in some climates, make possible to man a sort of Elysian life. Fuel, except to cook his food, is then unnecessary. The sun is his fire, and many of the fruits are sufficiently cooked by its rays. While food generally is more various and more easily obtained, and clothing and shelter are wholly or half unnecessary. At the present day, and in this country, as I find by my own experience, a few implements, a knife, an axe, a spade, a wheelbarrow, etc., and for the studious, lamplight, stationery, and access to a few books, rank next to necessaries, and can all be obtained at a trifling cost. Yet some, not wise, go to the other side of the globe, to barbarous and unhealthy regions, and devote themselves to trade for 10 or 20 years in order that they may live, that is, keep comfortably warm, and die in New England at last. The luxuriously rich are not simply kept comfortably warm, but unnaturally hot. As I implied before, they are cooked, of course, a la mode.
Now we return to Daniel Suelo's FAQ. Question 3. What do you do for food? Before I go into details, I'll say it's best if you don't think about where or how your food will come. It can be totally different for different people. The secret isn't knowing where or how your food will come, and never putting your trust in a single source, which could fail tomorrow. But it is simply about having faith, and letting what you need come automatically. Now, you have to ask yourself if these great sages, whom civilizations claim as their guiding lights, were telling the truth or not. And how can you know if you don't put it to the test and live by faith? Only a pseudo-scientist who fears truth doesn't dare put his or her hypothesis to the test. As a long set of quotations from Luke chapter 12, "Do not worry about your life, what you will eat, nor about the body, what you will put on. Consider the ravens, for they neither sow nor reap, which have neither storehouse nor barn, and God feeds them. Of how much more value are you than birds? Consider the lilies, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin. And yet I say to you, even Solomon, in all his glory, was not arrayed like one of these. If then God so clothes the grass, which today is in the field, and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, how much more you, O you of little faith? And do not seek what you should eat, or what you should drink, nor have an anxious mind. For all these things the nation of the world seek after. And your Father knows that you need these things, but seek the kingdom of God, and all these things shall be added to you." And from Tao Te Ching 22, "Be really whole, and all things will come to you." And Tao Te Ching 81, "The sage never tries to store things up. The more she does for others, the more she has. The more she gives to others, the greater her abundance." From the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 9, verse 22, "As for those who worship me, thinking on me alone and nothing else, ever attached to me, I bear the burden of getting them what they need." There's a quote from the Zen sage Ehi Dogen, "Students of the way, do not worry about food and clothing. Just maintain the Buddha's precepts and do not engage in worldly affairs. Those who truly study the way have never practiced with the priority of providing for their livelihood. Moreover, I have never read in the collection of all the Buddhist scriptures of a single Buddhist or ancestor who transmitted the Dharma in three countries, dying of starvation or cold. In this world, inherently, each person receives a certain amount of food and clothing as a gift. It does not come by being sought after, nor does it stop coming by not seeking after it. Just leave it to fate and do not worry about it. If you refrain from arousing the mind of awakening in this life, excusing yourself on the grounds that this is the degenerate age, in what life will it be possible to attain the way?" From the Quran, "And do not strain your eyes, longing for the things we have given for enjoyment, the splendor of the life of this world. The provision of thy Lord is better and more enduring. Enjoin continual prayer on your people. We ask you not to provide sustenance. We provide it for you. But the fruit of the hereafter is for righteousness." From Surah 29, verse 60, "How many are the creatures that carry not their own sustenance? It is for Allah who feeds them and you, for He hears and knows all things." From the Guru Granth Sahib by Guru Nanak Dev, page 7, "The birds have no money in their pockets. They place their hopes on trees and water. He alone is the giver. You alone, Lord, you alone." And from the sayings of Ramakrishna, number 262, "How can I go through with my devotional practices when I have always to think of my daily bread? He for whom you work will supply you with your necessities. God made provisions for your support before He sent you into this world. I have a freegan diet. I take what is freely given, with no obligation on either side. I forage for wild, feral, and domestic edibles. I also freely rely on human generosity. I live on waste. Dumpster diving, trash can fishing, table surfing, and sometimes asking people and food service institutions for extras and throwaways. I don't ask people to give me what they don't intend to throw out. I also eat roadkill, if it's fresh, of course. I've eaten squirrel, raccoon, rabbit, and deer so far. I've also hunted and eaten ants, grubs, grasshoppers, crickets, termites, lizards, snakes, fish, pigeons, and ducks. I think I'd be vegan if I used money, unless I could hunt. I don't want to support or encourage the animal industry, but I will eat fresh meat thrown into dumpsters. I hope to talk about the ethics of eating meat later. When I'm living near Moab in the Utah desert, I eat lots of wild plants. Plants of the mustard family are almost always edible, and found year-round, not only in Moab, but around the U.S. Watercress is a mustard, and plentiful in Utah streams. Then there's globe mallow, with edible leaves eaten in winter. Globe mallow is related to an edible mallow that grows in towns all over the U.S., too. Many parts of cattail are edible, though only in the warmer seasons. Evergreen needles of all kinds, including pines and cedars, are high in vitamin C and other vitamins and minerals, and make delicious tea, which I'm constantly drinking. Even high in the mountains, you don't have to worry about vitamin deficiencies if you think to drink delicious pine and cedar teas. I often eat prickly pear cactus pads, raw, through the winter, and prickly pear fruits in the summer. The fruits are delicious and juicy, a lot like a kiwi fruit, but you have to scrape off the micro-needles with a stone. Juniper berries are good for spice flavoring when green, roasting for a coffee substitute, and are good eating straight when ripe, brown-purple coloured. Wild onions are a winter and early spring treat. Mormon tea has a little pseudo-fed in it, good for colds, and the bark and buds of trees and shrubs in the willow family, including pussy willow, cottonwood, aspen, poplar, etc., contain a precursor to aspirin for pain relief in tea. Service berries and pinion nuts are a more rare treat. In town, I gather fruits and nuts from orchards and feral trees and bushes, mulberry, apple, peach, apricot, plum, almond, walnut, cherry, grape, and rose hips. Miniature crab apples are delicious in the winter after they've frozen and dried a bit. Honey locust beans can be a main staple, sustaining you all year long. The beans can be eaten raw when green, and when dry, must be cooked for a couple of hours like pintos. They're a little bit slimy, but high in protein. Some scholars believe that John the Baptist ate honey locust beans rather than locust and wild honey. Locust and wild honey possibly being a scripture mistranslation. When I'm hitching and walking, I can usually find varieties of mustard anywhere in the US, often year-round. Fennel is common along roadsides near the west coast, as well as amaranth. You can eat both the leaves and the seeds of amaranth. Thistle, related to artichoke, has delicious hearts and young leaves. I glean farmland and orchards for produce and nuts, too. I could go for weeks living on just fruit and nuts on the west coast. I once walked down the beach coast of Northern California for weeks and lived totally off the land, eating mussels, seaweed, berries, and shrubbery. I lived totally off the land in Alaska twice, eating salmon, berries, and mushrooms. My first time in Alaska, I speared salmon with my friend. My second time in Alaska, I found it was actually easier to catch salmon with my bare hands, very slowly moving my hands with patience. As for roadkill, as I've said, I've eaten squirrel, raccoon, rabbit, and deer so far, and hunted and eaten ants, grubs, grasshoppers, crickets, termites, lizards, snakes, fish, pigeons, and ducks. I can't in good conscience kill animals to eat them if I don't need to, when there are droves and droves of meat thrown away in dumpsters. It's the ultimate in waste and disrespect when animals live their lives, confined in cages, only to be killed and thrown into dumpsters by the tons every day. It's criminal not only for the animal's sake, but it's criminal when there are millions of humans on Earth who are starving. About the tyrants who try to retain their own waste, anal retention. Often, when you're caught at a dumpster by store owners, you're treated with contempt. What if what we considered contemptible and inexcusable were the waste of our society in a world where millions are starving? What if we considered it contemptible and ridiculous to actually lock up this waste, as most corporate dumpsters are, to keep hungry people from eating, and having the gall to act self-righteous in the process? Notice how corporate authorities almost always tell you it's for your safety. Notice that tyranny, in all its forms, all over the world, is almost always done for your safety, for your security. The corporate tyrant is turning the tables to look like the compassionate one, the intelligent one. The tyrant is telling you that you are not smart enough to take care of yourself, simply because the tyrant is a have and you are a have-not, somehow makes the tyrant worthy to treat you like a child who can't take care of yourself. The tyrant is also not speaking his or her own mind, not speaking from the heart, but is speaking a script programmed into him or her by the corporation that is paying him or her.